Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It's Monday, April 20th. The state woke up to the news of the passing of Governor George Ariyoshi. He was Hawaii's first governor of Japanese ancestry, and he had just turned 100 last month. We remember his life and legacy. State lawmakers are in the home stretch of the legislative session, lots of competing interests trying to shape the state budget. We also talk about recovery from the flooding and the impact of what was left behind. Think about the brown water advisories and cesspools. And the discovery of not one but two coconut rhinoceros beetles earlier this month on Molokai has the community on alert. We hear from boots on the ground. And a pigeon classic, a coming-of-age story, hits the stage for the first time. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Former Governor George Ariyoshi has died at 100. He was Hawaii's third governor and the longest serving in state history. Ariyoshi had just celebrated his birthday on March 12th, and just before that, his 70th wedding anniversary to his wife Jean in February. But his passing this weekend gave us pause to remember one of our last conversations that we had with him. In 2020, we spoke with him about his memories of World War II and the beginning of his political career in 1954. We asked what he would want his grandchildren to know about that time. He spoke about the importance of spreading friendship throughout the world, something that resonates during these volatile political times.
I think I want them to know that there was a very vicious war. America had never been involved in such a vicious war that so much at stake. But two nations at war against each other, coming together. And I think my children, I want them to know that no matter what happens, friendship between nations become very important. No matter what happens and why we got, what would happen to that point, it is important we try at any point to develop this friendship in a worldwide basis. That's what I want to happen. Friendship all over the world. And understanding the need for things to happen in order to make the friendship fashion. If America had not gone to war, ended the war, and conducted itself in the way that MacArthur and the Japanese, the American effort, the desire to have peace, desire to have a defeated nation get strong, rebuild, that the nation to become a democratic nation, a different kind of nation, and a friendship with the Constitution, the friendship developing between the two nations, that friendship is the most important thing that happened. Ambassador Mansfield talked about that, the most important bilateral relations bar none between two nations. That's what happened. And that's what I want my children to know, that their future is important and the future depends on what countries do. I think also, while the nations between, the relationship between Japan and America is very strong, and leaders come together, prime minister and president comes together, to me that's not enough. The people of both nations have got to feel this sense of friendship and the many bilateral relations that we create in America and other states and Hawaii, between counties and between the state, to me is very important. So that people in both nations can feel the importance of the Japan-U.S. alliance. Not just government, but the people itself also feel that alliance. One of the things I'm very grateful for is veterans who went to war and came back and didn't say, oh, we're going to bask in our glory. They came back and they look at, now look at Hawaii. They began to look at what kind of state they came back to. And they came back and found a lot of unfairness here in this community. And they participated in government and took over control of the legislature. For the first time in the history of their territory, we government was controlled, legislature controlled by the veterans, Democrats came back. They got me involved. I was one of the younger ones, but I had became the youngest member of that 1954 political revolution when we took over legislature for the first time. And what we did was we wanted to create fairness and equity for all the people of Hawaii. And if the government, the veterans, come back, had not participated, I do not know whether we would have been able to create that. And Noe, Bakumatsunaga, Russell Kono, Masato Doi, getting involved in that 1954 election, and I was the youngest member of that group. And we brought about and we created all the equalities and labor laws and land laws and housing laws made it possible for Hawaii to be a fairer, a better place.
And that's how you believe it changed Hawaii?
Yes. Listen, fighting the war, but coming back, fighting for justice and fairness in Hawaii.
And this morning, we spoke with Nate Ugiotoku, president of the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii. There at the Mo'ili'ili facility is a permanent exhibit that opened more than three decades ago. It's titled Okage Sama De, a Japanese saying that Governor Ariyoshi often spoke of. Here's Ugiotoku.
Governor Ariyoshi mentioned the phrase Okage Sama De, which is a value that we hear a lot, which is, I am what I am because of you. And it's a broad reference, but it could mean your ancestors or community. And I think he used it in all terms like that, where he viewed himself as a public servant. And he is in that role because of his family and his parents and his grandparents, but also his community that supported him.
Yes. And, you know, that saying is something that is just core to the Japanese community. And the fact that he was our first governor of Japanese descent, you know, was a big deal.
Yes, yeah, and he was the first Japanese American elected to governor in the United States. And I think one thing that makes me extremely sad today is Governor Ariyoshi was like that last tie that we had to that Nisei generation, the second generation of Japanese American immigrants in Hawaii that served in World War II, and then a lot of them ended up in public service, and he was like that last link to that generation. So it's a tremendous loss today for the community.
Well, you have the exhibit down there, and maybe that's a way for people to grieve, right? To walk through and consider his contributions and the contributions of everyone who helped him get to where he was.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, our exhibit frames, and Governor Ariyoshi does appear in the exhibit when we talk about the Democratic Party revolution in Hawaii in 1954, as he was a part of that ticket. But like many others, Governor Ariyoshi's story is baked into this immigrant story that we talk about in a broader sense that dates back to the sugar plantation era. So, you know, it's a very common story, especially folks like me who are fourth gen. Our own family roots are reflected in the stories that we talk about and include with Governor Ariyoshi. But yeah, it's a exhibit that kind of talks about that, and he's definitely represented in there as well.
Well, you know, when you think about that last generation, and included in your exhibit pictures of Dan Inouye and Spark Matsunaga, mm-hmm. and just that fabric of Hawaii's history.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think the Japanese community is interesting here because most of our ancestors came over in a pretty brief period of time before the border closed. So all of our families follow a similar-ish timeline. And Governor Ariyoshi's generation, that second generation, they were essentially the last link to those original immigrants that came over from Japan. They were this bridge of people that kind of connected us to our past. And as we move away from that, of course, that generation moves on. But we still look toward that second generation folks for the values and those kind of characteristics that they exemplify that we would like to continue on going forward.
As we reflect back upon his time in office, I know just the humility at which he carried the torch, right, on behalf of so many immigrants. You know, in his book, With Obligation to All, it just underscores that responsibility that he must have felt.
Yeah, and I think it's very reflective in the change of in political climate in the 50s. The Democrats were able to put together a broad coalition of different people, not only Japanese, but from different community members, a very diverse ticket with people with ties to labor unions and ties to the plantation. And I think Governor Ariyoshi saw himself very much as a part of that kind of broader coalition that, so when he had the chance to serve as governor, it seems like he tried his best to do what he could for the state, for everyone.
Well, I know he talked about the importance of education, and he had so many folks out there who worked alongside with him, right? Fudge Matsuda at the University of Hawaii. You know, they just shared that belief that was where our future needed to be.
Yeah, very much so. And you mentioned Fudge Matsuda, who passed away about 5 or 6 years ago. You know, that generation really looked at education as a key. And a lot of them were public school graduates. A lot of them went to McKinley or Roosevelt. And then through their service in the military, at least for folks like Ariyoshi and Inoue and Spark Matsunaga, got to go to college, you know, and have an opportunity to do good for the state. So I think they've very much felt investment in education was key for the entire community.
And as you consider his life and his contribution, you know, and I know he had so many ideas about tourism and Hawaii's future and the next steps. I don't know, what is it that you want to underscore?
So I think Governor Ariyoshi actually released another book more recently that kind of reflected on the states at the time when he was governing the strategic plan. And I think a lot of the things in there, as you see it today, gives you an insight into what they were trying to do as far as understanding that the plantation era was coming to an end and how do we create a new economy. And of course, hindsight's 2020, and I think there are things in there that maybe we look back and go like, well, maybe we would tweak. But I think in general, his cohort of folks were really trying to look forward and trying to create a more equitable Hawaii where we're not under five main companies that are controlling a lot of the economy. So I think it's very important when we think back to understand, like, during the time that governor was in office, there are a lot of things happening, including the Native Hawaiian Renaissance, right? All of those things are kind of happening all at the same time. And I think he tried his best to navigate it as best as he could.
That was Nate Gutoku of the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii reflecting on the passing of Governor George Ariyoshi. Ariyoshi died Sunday at the age of 100.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Musician, educator, and everything music YouTuber Rick Beato features live song breakdowns and interactive Q&A this Friday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Today on The Daily, for the past decade, the Supreme Court has relied on a rushed and secretive system to make major rulings. Now, for the first time, a Times investigation brings to light the precise moment when that system began. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
State lawmakers head into conference committees this morning to hash out differences on key bills as we count down the final weeks of the legislative session. The question of what to do about the state budget loomed large, with so much uncertainty with cuts to federal programs and the damage of nearly $1 billion from back-to-back storms. We spoke with Senate Ways and Means Chair Donovan Dela Cruz Friday about what's ahead. He represents part of the Waihawa District and is a proponent of boosting local agriculture.
So the Senate just passed over the budget to the House, so now we're going to be entering conference. We're about $250 million apart, so our budget is a little trimmer. at $250 million. And so what we wanted to make sure the Senate is that we provided the income tax breaks that were promised back in 2024 to our working families. So that's for families that households that make $350,000 or less, or $175,000 if you're a single filer, and $262,500 if you're a head of household. So if you're in that, if you make that amount or less, the tax breaks will be in place. And to pay for that, what we want to try to do is also sunset some of the tax credits. Our proposal is to sunset about $900 million worth of tax credits, because to save the income tax breaks and the standard deductions, that's going to cost about $1.8 billion.
And so who gets affected by that if the tax credits are sunsetted?
Yeah, so we're looking at some of the business tax credits, some of the energy tax credits, shipmaking tax credits. And so the way our proposal is written is that the tax credits will go on for another 3 years, because according to the financial plan and because of what Council of Revenues has forecasted, the state is projected to be in the red around year 2030. So that's why the tax credits will end or sunset in 2030. However, if as the economy gets better, the industries that are affected by the sunsets can always come back to the legislature and see if we can either extend the sunset or eliminate it or change the language for different types of incentives. It gives us time, but it also makes sure that we're fiscally going to be in the black by 2030.
Yeah, so at least you've built in some wiggle room in this budget.
And so that way we can afford to maintain the tax breaks.
Yes, and I know that was something that the governor had talked about suspending just because of where we were when this budget was first introduced. You're also going to be, what, eliminating or taking some money by eliminating the vacancies in state government?
Yeah, so the Senate's plan is several things to maintain the tax breaks. If the sunset of the tax credits, and we made some very strategic cuts, such as lapse amounts over the last 5 years, we took averages of the last 5 years and lapsed those from the different departments who were not spending that money. We also cut long-term vacancies, and we cut positions that are not being recruited. So the departments were not actively trying to fill those positions. Those were all cut. What we also did was we wanted to see if the authorities and the corporations that are all part of the state, take them off the general fund so that they would go back on special funds since they have the ability to generate their own revenue. So all of these different types of savings and takings from some of the carryover, we're able to afford to maintain the tax breaks.
And on the vacant positions, I know I was hearing stuff internally that human resources is shorthanded and there's been a lag in either advertising positions that are open or just making what used to work work. I mean, I know you were proposing to eliminate vacancies that have been open for 5 years. So you think that's enough time built in there?
If the department has not been able to fill it for 5 years or they have been recruited for a position, then, you know, those were positions where we felt, okay, if nothing's going to happen with them, then we're going to take them back. The positions that were actively being recruited because of exactly for what you just said, that we need to provide government services, we want to make sure that people are not going to be shorthanded. All of those positions that are not filled but that are currently in recruitment, we preserve those.
I know that there is concern not just with the federal funding cuts, right, to some of our safety net programs. There was this war, which we're hoping will end quickly, but that's still a concern. And then also this recent flood that just hit so many communities across the state. So what's the plan as far as recouping maybe any upfront monies that we have to put out there to help our people?
Well, for some of the safety net programs like Medicaid and SNAP, we've actually added about $88 million to make up for the federal funding cuts and some of the federal policy changes. So we wanted to make sure that that was going to be taken care of. We also added about $175 million to an emergency appropriation bill so that the governor can have monies available. Those numbers are still fluid. We're talking to the administration as to what's going to be the real number that they're going to need. And then we also added an additional $50 million in the major disaster fund for fiscal year 27. We also included about $2 million for a rent supplement program for Kupun. So we tried to take care of all of that, which is why we had to make the cuts that we made so that we can preserve the tax breaks and ensure that we take care of the disaster as well as preserving some of the safety net programs.
And just as far as the flooding, I know that affected an area that you represent. The impact to the farmers, I know, has just been devastating. And so you have ideas to help create a hub out there.
Yeah, so the governor had sent down a governor's message of about $43 million to make improvements to the dam once the dam is acquired. So we've been pushing for the state to acquire this dam for the last several years. They're in negotiations with Dole. There's Agribusiness Development Corporation, Department of Land and Natural Resources, Department of Agriculture and Biosecurity. They're all at the table. The last vote from one of those three boards just occurred this past week. So we're one step closer to acquiring not just the dam, but the lake. Once the state acquires those assets, then we can make the improvements that we need.
Yeah, and the whole idea is to keep that irrigation line available for our small farmers.
Yeah, so over the past several years, the state has been acquiring ag lands, and we have about over 4,000 acres of ag land now in central Oahu that we preserve. And we want to make sure that this whole agricultural belt from Kunia all the way to the North Shore is preserved. But in order to do that, you're going to need irrigation water. So having the dam and the lake and preserving the irrigation system that the plantation even used is going to be critical for food production, especially on Oahu.
Yes, and we've set some lofty goals to get local food into our schools, just to generate enough produce and that kind of thing to supply local needs. But this is obviously a setback.
Well, but we're moving forward. We're building the regional kitchen in central Oahu. That's one of about eight that the state wants to build across the state. That will create a higher demand for agricultural products. The Department of Education and Agribusiness Development Corporation are currently meeting with farmers to figure out a way how we can purchase from farmers a lot easier at smaller quantities, looking at ways of distribution so that they're not having to deliver to every school, maybe just several schools because that's what they can actually grow for. A lot of coordination is underway to see how we can build an ecosystem to meet those goals.
Well, as we move into the final weeks of this legislative session, and as far as the budget, what's your concern about maybe the House's position on where we should take this budget?
Well, as soon as we get into conference, we're going to be discussing different types of their philosophy versus our philosophy, see if there's something in that we can move closer towards so we can have a path forward. It's going to be difficult to work on the budget first, which is why we need to look at the financial plan, which includes all the different tax cuts, the tax breaks, the tax incentives, the tax credits, to see where we're at, because we need to figure out what the amount the state is generating so that we can pay for all the services that some legislators are pushing through bills or budget adjustments, and also to take care of some of the urgent needs that you discussed earlier.
That was Ways and Means Chair Senator Donovan Dela Cruz, who also serves Hawaii's 17th Senate District, which includes Mililani and Wahewa.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
I dare you to show me an economic indicator you think doesn't matter.
And so it's really this perfect storm of factors that are impacting tomato prices.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hey, how do you feel about BLTs, huh? Tariffs and their tomato trickle down next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
The flooding from the two Kona low storms left us with lingering brown water advisories. Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Chloe Jones has his stories published this weekend about the pollution left behind by cesspools across the state. Good morning, Chloe.
Good morning.
You know, we're not just talking, you know, when we hear brown water, right? It's not just the mud that comes down from the streams, but it's, you know, some of the treated and untreated wastewater that also gets into the ocean.
Yeah, yeah. And there's really two ways that wastewater gets into the ocean. And one is when sewer lines get inundated with, or I guess there's three ways. So sewer lines get inundated with groundwater. Wastewater treatment plants may be getting overfilled, and so they do discharges. And that third way is through cesspools. So cesspools, they are already discharging millions of gallons of raw sewage into the ocean every day, and that's in blue sky conditions. And so when these storms come, experts tell me that it essentially turbocharges the amount of sewage that rushes out into the ocean.
Yeah, and the risk is really for those residences that are on cesspools that are on the coast.
Yes, yeah, the coastal zones are all high priority cesspool zones, and they're the things that make a residential area a high priority cesspool zone are also similar to the factors that give it a flooding risk. So it's high groundwater, close to the coast, things like that. And so if you look at University of Hawaii's cesspool prioritization tool, you'll see that everywhere that had high flooding during these two Kona lows also has a high concentration of these high priority cesspools.
Yeah, so we're talking just bacteria. That's not good stuff, right? It's E. coli. It's, you know, we hear about leptospirosis. Just a lot of junk in the water that you don't want to be swimming in.
Yeah, you don't want to be swimming in really anything that has untreated human waste or otherwise in the water. And I think, too, there's also the effect on our coral reefs as well. The nutrients that come from human waste can cause algae overgrowth, which then kind of can help invasive algae grow too much. And then the coral no longer has enough space. And then it also, human waste also cannot, the pharmaceuticals that are in it is not ideal for coral health as well. So there's a lot of different factors that affect it, whether it's human health or coral reef health.
Yeah, yeah, all the fertilizer runoff, right, the nitrogen, that kind of thing. Not a good mix.
Yeah, nitrogen also comes from human waste as well. So there's two types. Nitrate is related to fertilizer, and ammonium is actually a byproduct of human waste. So you kind of have two forms of nitrogen going down, and that is what really causes the algae to overgrow.
And then we've also heard about the need to boil water in some mm-hmm. of these communities that were inundated by the flooding, and that's not good either.
No, yeah. So during the Kona low storms, areas of the North Shore had boil water notices, and just recently in Waialua, there was a boil water notice as well. While that, you can't say that that is directly related to cesspools, it is related to E. coli being found in the water, which essentially means that there was either human or animal waste coming in contact with the water. During these storms, especially during the boil water notices at the time of the Kona lows, that was related to whether it was cesspools or sewer, just waste was being detected in the water system.
And then I know you also reached out to VI, the Wastewater Alternatives and Innovations group, and I know that they've been trying to get some tax breaks for some of the people that need to go off cesspools and get onto something more environmentally friendly.
Yeah. So House Bill 1618 is currently in the legislature. It just got into conference committee, and that bill aims to create a cesspool loan fund and financing program to help make conversions more affordable. That really is the biggest barrier to homeowners being able to convert their cesspools. There's other variables as well, such as whether the terrain is easy to convert. Septic isn't the solution everywhere, and so when septic is not the solution and cannot work in certain areas, then it can drive the cost up even more.
Okay. All right. Well, I know you'll be tracking those bills, but thank you so much, Chloe.
Thank you.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Chloe Jones. Look for her story at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the HTDC Entrepreneur Sandbox in Kaka'ako, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai on her life before and after she was shot by a Taliban gunman. Payback for standing up against the Taliban and advocating for her right and the right of all girls to go to school. She's serious about her ongoing advocacy, but has a delightful sense of humor. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Hungary's newly elected prime minister praised the independent media outlet that launched his political rise. He called it
a channel that filled the gap for public media when public media was propaganda.
Peter Magyar vows to free up the media and will likely succeed, because the bar's so low.
You're being compared to Viktor Orban. You can only be great for the press.
On the next On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Legacy of Life Hawaii, dedicated to saving and enhancing lives through organ and tissue recovery, recognizing April as National Donate Life Month. Organ donor registration at registerme.org.
Invasive species crews on Molokai are on high alert after the discovery of the first two coconut rhinoceros beetles on the Friendly Isle earlier this month. No additional beetles were found over the weekend, but monitoring efforts have been complicated by the back-to-back Kona low storms. HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Packnell joins us live with more. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you've been out checking with your folks?
Yes, so the Molokai invasive species committee field crew has been hard at work doing overtime since these two beetles were found on April 7th and 8th. They were two adult beetles that were found in the invasive species committee traps. And they checked traps again island-wide on Friday, and there have been no new detections, so that's really good news. No larvae have been found on Molokai. They are bringing in a CRB detection dog at some point to help with the search for any more beetles that may be on island. And the Department of Agriculture staff is also coming over to help search for any breeding sites. Lori Buchanan has worked as coordinator of the Molokai subcommittee of the Maui Invasive Species Committee for over 30 years, and she says there's just been an outpouring of support statewide for this effort on Molokai. It's the last island that CRB was detected, and so it's, you know, really important for this to be hit head on as quickly as possible, which they are doing. Buchanan talked about the detection and what the Molokai field crew is doing in the immediate response.
With the recent find of the male beetle at the Malama Park in Kanakakai, which is the closest to the shoreline and the causeway to Molokai Wharf, and then the second find at Manaloa Highway due west at Mohana Stretch, we had to look at the timing and then consult the entomologists and the experts of the biology of the CRB beetle to see where we might be in the breeding cycle of the beetle to figure out if they were just hitchhiking on shipments coming in from Molokai, or if we already have a population and this is the early emergence that we're seeing. Because of the biological nature of the pest, which is highly, highly invasive, we know that it's going to be very difficult if we already have breeding sites. So the immediate plans for response on Molokai is to set up traps around the areas that we found the dead beetle, and then to look and eliminate potential breeding sites, which is green waste, mulch, decaying material, which is everywhere on Molokai.
And you mentioned that those beetles were found in traps. How many traps do they have out?
So right now they have over 70 traps across the island that are put out by the Molokai Invasive Species Committee. And the purpose of these traps is for early detection. The purpose is not necessarily to use the traps as a control method, but they are really helpful for, you know, again, finding those beetles and knowing that they're on island, which is a really important step, of course. And so these two beetles were found on April 7th and April 8th. Before that, the traps were last checked on April 1st with nothing found. So it was just that week period. And the larvae stage lasts for 3 to 4 months. And so as Lori was talking about, if there are breeding sites already, it's sort of this race against time, right, to try and find those sites before they hatch in just a few months. So the crew has been monitoring for CRB on Molokai since 2014. That was the year after the first CRB was found on Oahu, the first sighting in Hawaii. And, you know, by 2024, they had over 40 traps across the island. So this isn't new. It's not like these traps are suddenly going out now that the beetles were detected. They have already put out over 30 new traps around the detection sites since those first findings. And so there's three field crew on Molokai. They're really swamped. They're assembling these traps, deploying them, monitoring them, responding to reports. They've gotten a lot of community reports coming in, you know, just people worried, you know, no new sightings again. But people are on guard, which is great. Community is on the lookout. GPS records, really important for real-time, you know, tracking of everything that they're doing. And, you know, again, checking for these potential breeding sites, digging for larvae in mulch and green waste. Laurie Buchanan says they are looking to hire 2 to 3 new staff to help with all of this, asking for residents' help in, you know, again, looking for CRB larvae in the ground in mulch piles, as well as any signs of the adults, you know, damage, bore holes in the palms. And reporting is really, really important. So she's asking, you know, before people destroy the larvae or the adults to report those so that they can confirm, you know, that they are, in fact, CRB. There's some lookalikes. And so, you know, CRB doesn't just attack palms. You know, they eat hala, banana, kalo, you know, so much more, along with just coconut trees. Lori calls the potential loss of these plant species, you know, just really devastating to the island's environment as well as subsistence lifestyle. Here she talks about it.
We're not going to give up. We're going to do everything humanly possible to treat this pest right now. Also, always vigilant into the future, like coqui frog. You know, most people on Molokai don't know that we've detected coqui frog several times. We don't have a breeding population. But it comes in intermittently by shipment, by whatever way. And so you're always vigilant. So we maka'ala. Unfortunately, our job is dealing with the worst pests. And again, our mission is to take care of incipient pest species before they become established. And that's our job, period. That's what we're going to do now. Especially for CRB. It's so devastating. It's like rapidohia death. There's two things that I fear most. Is the loss of our primary overstory tree for the island of Molokai. Is ohia in the forest. I remember sleepless nights thinking about us having rapidohia death come to the Molokai forest. So this is the same thing with CRB. The loss of all of our coconut trees, palm species, is absolutely devastating. First to culture, And then second to just island as a whole. It's like Molokai is the last place that you can have beta repository for all these great perpetual species of genetic integrity of coconut species. And if we let one bug do that to us, then it's just devastating. So that's why we're going to do whatever we can do. We're going to scale up. And we're going to act like it's here and it's breeding. And that's how we're going to proceed.
Yeah, it's a big job. And, you know, it's just tough because knowing they've just been recovering from the storms, it just makes it all that more complicated. But thank you so much, Catherine, for the story.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel. You can read that story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's been almost three decades since the writer Lois Ann Yamanaka published her third novel titled Blues Hanging. It was lauded as a landmark work of contemporary Hawaii literature. The gritty coming-of-age story set on Molokai takes center stage at Kumukuhua Theater this month. Written mostly in Pidgin, the Ogata family's story of loss and resilience has been adapted for the stage for the very first time by R. Zamora Lindmark and directed by Jason Konda. The Conversation's Lillian Song sat down with Yamanaka to talk about writing and seeing her characters come alive on stage.
It's kind of a surreal experience because the characters only exist in my head. And when I sit in the audience, I'm kind of above the stage looking down, and it looks like I see chess pieces moving in real time. It's a remarkable experience, especially because the actors at Kumukuhua Theater, they embody the characters in ways that I don't expect.
So it's having somebody else's creativity work in conjunction with your work.
Exactly. So it's like the relationship with the person who adapts my work. It's very important that I have a real trusting relationship because I'm giving my work to them. And I normally don't have the privilege of doing that because when my book goes into a classroom or into somebody's hands, I'm not there. I cannot, you know, see or determine how people are going to treat my work. And then to have him and the director put it in the hands of performers, it's like all these layers of creativity and expression, and it's just a very heartfelt experience.
What is it like for you seeing all your characters go from page to stage now?
When I'm writing my books, it's the use of multi-layering metaphor and theme and three-dimensional characters for me that I carry through the novel. So because of the subjects that I write about in this book, for this experience with Zach and Jason, it's been interesting to see the threads they pull from the tapestry because of the limitation of time on the stage. Zach told me when I went to the table reading, and it was a cold reading, and the actors sat on a stage with chairs, and I was in the audience. He says, "You're going to cry." And then I said, "Make me." So I had a very resolute determination not to give him the satisfaction of a tear. But by the end, the actors that they cast were so incredible. And for the first time in a very long time, I was able to experience, I call it the ugly crying, but I just let it out, and I experienced that again at the cold table reading. And so I'm really amazed, and I'm really grateful for the way that my characters and what I was really trying to say, that's so complicated and layered, that they found the threads to follow. Loose Hanging is a story that touches on topics like alienation, exile, abandonment. It's a book about abuse and poverty and hunger and grief and loss and, you know, all these universal topics that no matter how you say it, I think if you say it in Pidgin or you say it in another dialect, what rises above the dialect and the rhythm and music of the dialogue, the language, what happens is that we're all human. And when those universal themes resonate, you know, animal abuse and people trying to keep their families together and decisions that are so difficult to make when you don't have resources and our education system. You know, I told myself from the very beginning, so I think people should know that I began writing with three promises that I made to myself. And the first one was, I will never censor myself again. Never. I went to the University of Hawaii when I was 17. During my undergraduate years, I was so ashamed of the way that I spoke, because even if I tried to talk in standard English, we still had the music and the cadence of Pidgin has its own kind of integrity. And I didn't want people in my class to think I was stupid. Mm-hmm. So I censored myself. I didn't ask questions. And I was afraid to approach my professors. And I carried this shame on my back until I was 27.
10 years.
Yeah. And then what my second promise I made to myself was, I will never let anyone else censor me again. And then the third promise that I made at age 27 was that I'm going to give back as generously to this gift that God gave me in every way possible. So as generously as I was given and I received the gift, I'm going to give it generously back whenever asked. I'm really kind of, at my age now, I'm proud of myself. I'm proud that I kept my promises.
You stayed true to yourself.
Exactly.
So staying true to that voice or to that writing in your cadence of Hawaiian Pidgin.
Right.
Blues Hanging, it's set on Molokai.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Things are slow there, but like you're saying, there's poverty, there's dysfunction in the family,
mm-hmm.
and it's a coming-of-age story.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like just the characters themselves are so vivid and so unique.
Mm-hmm.
Where did they come from?
Characters are always a composite of people, and their lives are built on a composite of experiences that I have witnessed. And it's very difficult for me to stand at the edge of the cliff like that and look down and just see, I gotta jump into that ravine, that gulch, because that's where the truth is, and it's in my body down there. So it's a leap of faith, because when I jump over the cliff, I don't know how I'm going to land. I might break a couple bones. I might hit my head against a ledge. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen to my characters. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I do it because I think that's what art is, all forms of art. I mean, we all can write, but an artist has to write and witness and observe and look at the truth through the lens of not only intuition, but the importance of being present and saying things that people might not agree with. But it was important to me, and it was important to my characters. Mm. It was important to my history and where I came from and the way that I was raised and the cultures that I was raised in. I couldn't do it any other way.
Audiences are definitely going to get a taste of local life. And it's wonderful to have these stories
mm-hmm.
out there for us to read and then to also chew on, talk about amongst
right,
ourselves.
Right. What formed my decisions to write Daryl Lum, I heard him say at a conference that until you see yourself in literature, you don't exist. And what you do see are depictions of yourself as though through a snow globe where somebody's looking in. But when you see yourself in literature, you're coming from the inside out and you write about places that you know and experiences, good and bad, that we've all had. It was so true because there weren't any young adult books. You know, there were pioneers in literature, you know, Milton Murayama, and then the Reverend Ruth Tabra wrote young adult books. And I would have to read them over and over and not know where to go next. And with my books, every book that I've written, when I put the last period down on the page and I know my book is going to end, I really take a long, long breath and express my gratitude for the stories that I was given and the experiences that I was given in my life. And then I always have my current alcoholic beverage of my of the time. Mm. So for Blues Hang, it was Merlot. So I got a bottle of good Merlot. I don't know when in my day I'm going to put that period down. And what I've come to find out was that everybody's still at work. Because it might be at 12 noon. It might be at, you know, 8 o'clock at night. It might, there's no determining when the last period comes. So I used to want to be with people, you know, and toast and
celebrate.
Just, but it's become something so personal for me because I got to celebrate my characters and my work and my own courage and determination. And sometimes that's difficult to do, you know, in light of all of my experiences with my published work. But I toast myself and I toast, I don't want to call it the muse, I toast my Heavenly Father and thank Him that I had the chance in this life to do something that meant something.
That was writer Lois Ann Yamanaka and HPR's Lillian Song. Yamanaka was born on Molokai, grew up on the Big Island, and went to the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Her poetry and novels have garnered the American Book Award, the Hawaii Award for Literature, and the Elliot Cates Award for Literature. The world premiere of Blues Hanging continues through April 26. And Kumukahua Theater, we should mention, is an HPR underwriter. You can find links at hawaiipublicradio.org. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the Small Business Administration what you need to know about applying for aid from the recent storms and flooding. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.